Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Now, sometimes we have to make financial decisions while we're under stress. We may have no choice, but it's important for us to be aware how that stress can affect our decision making. So, with many of us facing financial uncertainty at the moment, how can we face up to financial decisions and work our way through the process in as calm and rational a way as possible? With me now to talk about how to make good financial decisions when you're worried, we have John McNicholas, Managing Director of Ethical Financial. You're very welcome to the show, John. How are you?
Good, thanks, Ronan. Good to be with you.
Yeah, good. First of all, John, it's a turbulent time for nearly everyone in the country at the moment, isn't it?
It is.
So what sort of challenges are you hearing from your own clients?
Yeah, I mean, with the best will in the world, I don't think anyone foresaw the extent of how this is going to play out.
Absolutely.
For everyone, you know?
Yeah.
So, the biggest challenges I've seen, I suppose, are most people managing their finances, probably myself and yourself included, have a kind of a monthly rhythm or a weekly rhythm where you get paid and you pay your bills and all, you know, and the usual kind of rhythm you have of managing your money. And COVID, I suppose, has put a big jolt in that for everyone and put a bit of fear into a few months down the line, I have money this month, but I might not have money in three months' time.
Exactly. Yeah, that's precisely the thinking. People are going, look, oh, phew, managed to make it through, but I've no idea what's coming.
Yes, exactly, and that probably brings a bit of fear. Well, naturally, it brings a bit of fear with it. You know, it probably most of us are probably in jobs that we thought was stable. You know, and I suppose this is probably throwing that up for people, and there's a good bit of fear, which is natural, you know.
Indeed, absolutely.
So that's probably the biggest challenge for people.
Of course.
Fear has probably been the biggest challenge so far, as opposed to actual people running out of money. It's probably the fear of running out of money.
How we
deal with that.
And I was even thinking, you know, from a faith perspective, you know, pressing in and going, look, we've, you know, just deal with today, let tomorrow look after itself, and we'll figure out what comes. Now, I know your job generally in this particular area is to be thinking about tomorrow, but it is, you know, it's a tough one.
I know, yeah, you're right. Like, there's a fine line between between overly worried about it, but also, on the other hand, being maybe a bit naive and just and not actually thinking too far ahead.
Of course.
So you're right. So our job is to try and... most of my job, Ronan, is to try and help people get educated, really, in finance.
Yeah.
And help them make good decisions more than it anything else, you know.
So
my experience has been... Go on, sorry.
Sorry, I was going to ask you, you know, what's the situation like for something like, and I know this is an area that you do deal with, like first-time buyers, you know, might have a mortgage approval, salaries are now in doubt, everything's kind of up in the air, and they thought they were home dry. Well, maybe not home dry, but they were ready to at least, put, you know, go out and put offers on houses. What do you do?
Yes. Now? Yeah, well, look, I mean, the first thing is the banks have taken care of a lot of decision for that people, and that anyone... Most people who have mortgage approval only, or who are looking for mortgage approval from the banks, and if their income has been affected by COVID, most of the banks aren't allowing them proceed with house purchases at this point.
Yeah, so they're not actually honouring that kind of, you know, the mortgage cert or whatever you call it. Yeah,
No. You'd have to be a few stages further for the bank to kind of honour that. So if people are in jobs where they're not likely to be affected by this, they might be in tech jobs or in pharma jobs or in state jobs. I don't see any immediate reason to stop what you're doing, stop the plans. But anyone affected by COVID, I think the banks are probably making that decision for you.
Absolutely.
And I think that's probably, on balance, probably the wise decision not to plough ahead into something if you're unsure of your income at this point.
Sure.
Boring as that may sound to people,
no,
I'm breaking a few hearts there. But
it does make sense. And how about people running their own small businesses? What sort of actions are they needing to take at the moment?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, as someone who manages a small business, that's been a challenge for everyone, really. You know, there's been the problem with recession, as you know, or any kind of an economic downturn, is that it's we're all reliant on each other.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, your Spirit Radio are reliant
absolutely,
on
absolutely, yeah, like it's all
people
boats.
Paying money,
and
everyone is kind of interdependent in that. So when you have something like this, it's a challenge, particularly for small businesses, because they will see a loss of income. But I suppose, the biggest thing, you're probably seeing it a lot with social media, it's an advantage of it, is that at least small businesses can stay visible now, and to let people know they're still around, they're still trading. And probably my biggest advice is what they're needing to do is to batten down the hatches for a few months until the lockdown is over and until trade starts again. But probably my advice is there is a bit of temptation to run down reserves or use overdrafts or take loans from banks, and that is probably the
worst thing you could be doing.
It probably is one of the worst things to be doing at this point is to go further, to try and go too further into debt. So my advice is just trying to survive and stay visible until trade will start back up again in a few months' time. There isn't any doubt about that. You know, the world and Ireland will restart.
Not to try and get yourself into
further trouble, really. Just trying to hold fire for a few months.
Absolutely. Now, I think probably for the vast bulk of people, that there may be some possibility of doing that in some form, a mixture of kind of, pulling in the kind of expenditure and the rest. But there's certainly people, particularly people in business who might be halfway through, for instance, some sort of a transaction, something's on the way. The pressing pause isn't really an option. And waiting and seeing how things pan out. They need to make some decisions now, even though they may be feeling a lot of stress and anxiety. What do you do in those particular situations?
Yeah, I think the first thing, Ron, is you're right. Like these kind of events and the current crash, at the moment brings a lot of people. As you said, some can kind of stutter along the road, use the government supplements for staff, for themselves, to try and keep their wages topped up and wait till the pan's out. But for some people, it's almost like a fork in the road. You know, do I go left or do I go right?
Sure.
And you're kind of presented with those options, left or right, and you don't have a huge amount of time to decide on it. And that's probably what brings in obviously stress and fear for people, and that's fine to some extent, fight or flight mentality, but really like with financial decisions they usually have quite a few knock-on implications. So my first advice is to really just press pause. If someone is asking for you for a deadline tomorrow,
just say you
need to ask for an extension. Yeah. You can't give that answer tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Because you just haven't had time to consider it. And that would be what I would say to anyone making financial decisions, Ronan, anyway, is take some advice on board and do stop and consider it for a while before you do anything.
I suppose isn't that one of the things at the moment, John, is that like, you know, I was again just saying to the listeners there, I was on a Zoom call and, you know, from like old mates, and we were literally all over the world, you know, every part of the world, and we were all locked down. It was bizarre, you know. The one thing that you can say is everybody is in this situation. So if you're talking supply chain and you're getting something in from, the other side of the world, that person knows that there's a problem.
Yeah.
You know, you're not having to explain yourself to them. So it's saying to somebody, look, can you just hold out? Don't send it yet, or send it and we'll get the money to you, or whatever.
Hold fire for a bit. Yeah. And generally, like, finance is quite a complicated area, and as is business. And it's probably one of the most important areas in life to try and get some help with or to be educated on. So you'll find yourself in a position where you have to make a left or right decision. And usually you don't have the resources or the wherewithal to make a good decision at that point. I think that's probably the first and foremost thing. It's just not to be embarrassed about asking for help or trying to educate yourself. You know, giving yourself a bit of time to learn a bit more, to take a second opinion on board, and to think it through a bit more. You know, and I think that's probably and that goes across the board. That's not just related to COVID. That's generally speaking. Rushed or panic decisions tend not to be good, particularly in investments. People say, you know, if someone has a long-term investment in mind, they say they're just with fight or flight, they say, you know, cancel everything straight away. Take it out, which is usually not the right advice.
Absolutely.
And the alternative to that is to be naive and just do nothing. Yeah. And just let it go ahead without it. And that's probably also not great advice.
I get you.
There should be time to try and get yourself some good education.
You mentioned fight and flight. There's also has freeze. So freeze is the thing you don't do either. Any final thoughts on how things are likely to develop over the coming months and how households can plan ahead?
Yeah, I think the same point, certainly for households planning ahead. The whole issue of budgeting in Ireland is probably managing your own finances, not something we're particularly good at anyway. There's very little education on it in schools or in universities. We're all just get a first job and, you know,
spend.
running out of money every month is their only learning, and we hopefully get better at not running out of money at the end of each month. And that's probably an area where I think I've personally tried to educate myself on over the last year. I've took on some budgeting advice from a professional in that field personally.
Wow.
Try and help manage finances, and she will be available for her own customers.
Brilliant.
In the next few weeks, just to actually, it's a bit daunting learning about budgeting, and you kind of feel a bit of self-criticism or blame or something. And my biggest advice to people is to not feel daunted or embarrassed by the fact that you don't have a great handle on managing your finance. Most people don't. It's not easy, but it's something can be learned quite quickly. And there's good resources on the MABS website. That are free to use, and as I said, our own clients or anyone, Spirit Radio listeners, can get in touch, and we'll be able to help them with finance. But I think when you have confidence managing your household expenses, because they are likely to be a bit lower, whatever we say, you know that when Ireland picks up again, there is going to be a recession and less spending, so wages are likely to be a bit lower for a lot of people. So I think when you've given yourself every opportunity to manage your finances well and to have confidence in that, I think people will come through that a lot easier.
Yeah.
You know, so there don't think there's any doubt, Ronan, that I've been misleading you to say in 3 months' time the world will go back to, you know, Ireland
the way
back
it was.
To the same level. It won't go back to that level. It's not realistic.
Yeah.
So I think people just need to be probably cognizant of, you know, what I don't know, really. I don't know exactly how to deal with this. Don't know the good decisions to make. So I'm going to spend a bit of time, I'm going to freeze, as you said, spend a bit of time getting educated, understanding what I have in terms of money in the bank, what I have in terms of insurance policies, are they relevant, can they cover me, pensions, and just probably your spending day to day. And the more confidence you get in that, I think people will get through it a lot easier and come out the other side, whereas I suppose the alternative to that of doing nothing will bring more stress probably, you know.
Brilliant. John McNicholas, Managing Director at Ethical Financial. Thank you so much for talking to us today. God bless you, man. Bye-bye. Spirit. We're all having to learn how to do things differently during the current crisis, as, you know, I suppose we were probably just talking about that. And our next guest has been working with young people who have been doing things differently anyway, because they've been doing extra schooling, use a Japanese education method called Kumon. So how does this teaching method work? And how has it been affected by the COVID-19 restrictions? Here now to tell us more, we have Porik Quinlan, the instructor at Kumon Dundrum Study Centre in South Dublin. You're very welcome to the show, Porik. How are you?
I'm very well, Ronan. We live in interesting times.
We certainly do. First of all, Porik, can you tell us what the Kumon system of education is? How does it work?
Certainly. The key thing about Kumon, Ronan, is that it's individualised for each child. It's supplementary maths and English for children of all ages and abilities.
Right.
Mostly primary school children, some secondary school children. And the key thing about it is, as I said, it's individualised for each child. We don't make any assumptions. We don't say, OK, Connor, you're in fourth class, so you start here. We don't do that at all. We assess each child individually, closely. So, for example, if I'm doing a maths assessment of a child in third or fourth class, if I'm watching them closely and I see they're doing, for example, 6 plus 7, sometimes the fingers will come out and I'll say, hang on one second, Connor, what's 6 plus 6?
Yeah.
And sometimes they'll say 12, sometimes they won't. And if they say 12, I say, okay, 6 and 6 is 12, so what's 6 plus 7?
Yeah, very good.
And they may or may not get that link, and whether they do or not, I'll make a note of that. So I'm learning as much as I can about what's going on in the brain of that child.
Brilliant.
So I make notes, I build up a picture, build up a profile, I study them, then I determine, based on what I see, a starting point for that child. It's always a comfortable starting point, because in my experience, and I've been doing this now for about 8 years, Ronan, in my experience, the reason the fingers come out is lack of confidence, a fear of making mistakes.
Yeah.
There's this aura about maths, and sometimes English as well, that that's for the smart kids, that's hard. But if you break it down, bring it back to basics, and bring a child back up at a pace that is appropriate for them, it's amazing what you can achieve.
You know, when I hear child-centred learning as opposed to, you know, classroom where everything focuses on the teacher, I immediately think of Maria Montessori. So I may be wrong in that, because this might be a very, very different system. What is it? Where does it come from? Where did the kind of initial thought come from about how to do this?
There was a maths teacher called Mr. Kumon. Some people are disappointed in that. They think Kumon has a meaning in the Japanese language. Mr. Kumon. back over 50 years ago, and his own child was having difficulty with maths, and he put some thought into the best way to bring him, his child, back up to where he was, and it just evolved over the 50 years and it's gone global. And one of the things that's at the heart, Ronan, that would surprise a lot of people, I don't teach the kids in the conventional sense.
Okay, tell us.
If a child comes to us with a question that they don't understand, we don't just tell them the answer. We try to reframe it. We ask them how they did the previous question and the one before that, because they don't get, you know, dramatically harder. They're incremental. So we bring them back to the previous question, or we ask them a question that we know they know the answer to, because we know all the kids very well. And then we ask them to relate to that. And sometimes we'll give them 10 or 15 second silence for the cogs to turn in their head until they figure around and have that light bulb moment where they say, oh, I get it, it's 17.
Right.
And then they go back to their desk, delighted with themselves, because if they figure out the answer, they're more likely to remember it and get value out of it. Another example would be how we introduce division. So we would introduce division in maths after a child has been doing and mastering multiplication. And when they're doing a new topic, that would always be in class. So they come to class and they turn open this page and it says 6 multiplied by something equals 18. And if they know their tables well enough, they just, yeah, they know it's 3. And then 7 multiplied by something is 35. And they say, well, I know 7 fives is 35, so they put in the 5. Without knowing it, they're dividing.
Yeah.
They're doing division backwards.
Very good.
They turn over the next page and it says 7 multiplied by 3 is 21. 21 divided by 7 is 3.
Yeah, and you're making all those connections. It's brilliant. You know, I'll talk to you in a minute about how that applies to something like English as opposed to just maths, but I'm picturing you there in Dundrum and I'm going, who comes for this? Who has a requirement, or who recognises the need in themselves or in their child and goes, do you know what they need? They need the Kumon method.
Very good question, Alan. We would have children, I suppose 3/4, to pick a number, would be students who are having difficulty. A parent has had a parent-teacher meeting, or the parent is engaged with their child's homework, they're observing it, and they see mistakes, they see difficulties, they see they're not getting a concept, whether that's in maths or English. They don't know what a verb is in English. They don't understand the difference between tenses in English or whatever it might be. And then they go Googling.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, they'll hear it word of mouth. Word of mouth is probably one of our strongest marketing.
So you're seeing people outside. It's not like you have a kind of a regular school that people go to 9 to 3 or 9 to 4.
I didn't really explain that. I have a class in normal times. I'm still in COVID mode.
Okay.
I have a class in normal times on a Wednesday and a Saturday.
Okay.
So the students come once a week. They collect their homework. They take their new homework for the following week. My staff record how they've been doing that week, how long it's been taking them, how many errors they're making. We observe them in class. So every week I gather this information from every child, and every week I reset their homework. If I see that they're doing it comfortably, time-wise, without too many errors, I'll move them on. If I see they're taking a bit longer than I'd like them to, or they're making a few more errors than I'd like them to, or any other reason, I'll repeat that work.
Right. And are these children who are already in school somewhere else, or are they coming to you exclusively for school?
No, supplementary, 100%.
Right. Absolutely supplementary.
Yeah.
So it's really, really fascinating to me that, you know, so in a way you don't have to kind of create a curriculum, as it were.
Correct.
You kind of hook yourself into whatever is going on in the child's life. It's really, really fascinating. What is it like for you as a teacher right now to be teaching remotely, particularly this kind of stuff?
It's lonely. Every teacher
relatives,
the interaction with kids.
Yeah, so
the eye contact and the interaction and the little chats, because it's not a sweatshop.
No.
It's not kids coming along and coming out crying and sweating and red faces. They come along, they do their work, it's very routine.
Yeah.
Most kids are engaged and excited by doing new work. They're doing roughly 15-20 minutes worth of work every day. They do homework 7 days a week, they do it throughout the year. So it just becomes part of their life.
Yeah.
We always give a comfortable starting point. We want to build up their confidence and we want them to be able to make Kumon part of their 7-day routine.
Yeah, just listening to you, Porrick, you know, I'm imagining that idea of you know, like keying into an individual child, getting the sense of where they're at, getting into their process, helping them, listening to the cogs turning and giving them some space. And then if they come up with the thing that is the answer, it must be a tremendous feeling of reward in that for you.
Hugely, Ronan. We work with super bright kids who can do maths just comes to them, or English just comes to them, you know, they just see no difficulty. And that's great to see. I have kids who are in primary school and they're doing differentiation that I did in engineering in UCD.
Wow.
And that's great to see.
Yeah.
But I also have kids who, when I assess them, their confidence is on the floor. They have no self-belief at all. And then 3 or 4 months later, they come in with their chest out and they say, I came fifth in my Friday test.
Wow.
And that is just so rewarding.
Fab.
Great to see. You know you're making a difference.
Yeah,
a big difference in that child's life.
And again, you know, like you just mentioned there that you're an engineer. And I know the way it's set up, if you're going to engineering anywhere, really, you're set for out you go now and get into industry or get into whatever. And you've decided to go into education. So how is that for you?
When I started working in engineering, I was in product support and did a lot of training courses. I considered teaching as a career and just tossed the coin and it came up engineering. So I did consider teaching. So this was a way in later life of going back to
what you loved.
Education.
Yeah.
And I'm getting
a
huge kick out of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're made for it, obviously. You know, you sound like a great fit, you know. So listen, what advice or encouragement would you have for the student who is just finding it hard to keep going without the direct, you know, the in-person interaction with teachers and other students at the moment?
Well, I do video calls during the COVID situation, so I have slots that parents can book online between 9:30 and 1:00. So there is some contact.
Okay.
And video isn't quite eye to eye or sitting opposite a child, but it's an awful lot better than nothing.
Than nothing, gosh.
So if a child is having difficulty, I sympathise with them on a video call. I say, yeah, I'm the same. I miss going to class too. It's not easy. But I encourage them that it's going to have an end. I say, remember the time there was a blizzard and you couldn't leave your house for 3 or 4 days? But now it's all over and it's just a memory. I said, this will be the same.
Right, very good.
So I said, just do make the best of it. And I always say to kids, we're all on a team here. We're the same team. Me, you and your parents, we're on the same team.
Yeah.
And we're working together and we'll continue to do that. And we'll all be stronger by the end of it.
Brilliant. Pádraic, can we just find out where people can contact you?
Sure. There's a website, as usual, kumon.ie. That's KUMON. And there are 30 centres around Ireland, all around there's a number around Dublin and all around Ireland.
Right.
So kumon.ie.
Okay. Pádraic Quinlan, instructor at Cumann Dundrum Study Centre in South Dublin. An absolute pleasure talking to you today. Thank you for joining us.
You too. Many thanks,
Roma. Bye-bye. Spirit. Now, our next guest is a father who worked as a full-time carer for his daughter, Kayla, after she received a diagnosis at the age of 2 of neurodevelopmental disorder. He set about looking to see what he could do to support Kayla's health through good nutrition, and this had led him to founding Kayla's Kitchen, a business which now provides ready-made meals of great quality food, and all recipes are approved by Kayla, who is now 12, by the way. So with me this morning to tell us more about the story, we have Emmett Harton, founder of Kayla's Kitchen. You are very welcome to the show, Emmett. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Good to be with you.
Yeah, so listen, if you can get a 12-year-old eating everything, I tell you, you're a better man than me, Emmett. Fair play to you. First of all,
she has a good palate and a fantastic appetite.
Yeah, that's fantastic. First of all, Emmett, can you tell us a bit more about Kayla and your family story?
Yes. Well, Kayla is 12 now, but when she was around two and a half, she was diagnosed with a condition known as Rett syndrome, which is a non-hereditary genetic mutation that causes havoc with a child's development. We didn't really notice it at the very, very start when she was a baby, but we started to notice problems as she hit about 1 and she wasn't walking and she wasn't learning to talk and she was losing skills, any skills that she had acquired.
You were her full-time carer at the time. At that stage, are you beginning to panic or what's the story?
It's a kind of a growing concern because, you know, I was looking after her day in, day out, and you know, I've a huge effort to try and get her to learn how to use a simple block toy or how to just climb a step or two. And then, you know, within weeks, you notice that she's lost that skill. And that's that really starts setting alarm bells off. And we started visiting the different doctors and trying to find out why she was constantly chewing her fingers and she would never take her fingers out of her mouth. And, she was 2 before she learned to walk at all.
Right.
So, yeah, I describe it as a growing sense of unease and, you know, a constant effort to try and not think the worst.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then it becomes the worst.
You're kind of looking. You're looking down the line at other kids and going, maybe she's still a little slow here or there, and maybe she'll catch up, and all these kinds of things.
Yeah, you're looking. You know, you're looking. You're saying, oh, it's only dyspraxia. It's not something else. Like a brother actually cottoned on or latched on to Rett syndrome before the doctors did.
Seriously.
And we thought, no, well, it's not autism. It's not. It's only dyspraxia.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, you end up getting the worst, and you know,
and at devastating. What point, Emma, did you feel like the penny kind of dropped with you?
Oh, we weren't listening to any pennies dropping.
Really? Yeah.
No, it was the diagnosis. The in Temple Street, the doctor just hit us with it, and it knocked us for six.
Gosh.
We really weren't entertaining any prospect of it being as serious a diagnosis as it was.
And what age was she at that point?
By that point, she was, I think, 2.5, coming
right.
upon. She was 2 years old, yes, February of 2010.
So like an absolute nuclear explosion going off for you, I suppose.
It laid waste. I mean, there's nothing. You just, the world is grey. There's nothing going through your head, really, except some kind of sense of doom.
So out of that, did the Kayla's Kitchen thing begin to form in your mind?
It did. I had been making all her food from the time she had gone on to solids. I'd been making everything, and when she got the diagnosis, I got straight to work reading all about what we could do to give her the best chance in every sense, in terms of education, but also what I was finding was that nutrition was extremely important in giving her the best chance in the long run in terms of growth, in terms of general health, in terms of digestion, in terms of being able to walk and have the energy and promoting her brain development and all of that. So I started focusing on the best balanced nutrition across the day. And then what I noticed very quickly was that because of her condition, she's deprived of the use of her hands, she can't speak, she has very poor attention, she has learning difficulties, and I noticed that she took particular joy and satisfaction in her food.
Wow.
As one of her senses.
Brilliant.
So I tried to focus also on bringing out the most robust kind of flavors, like really diverse flavors, so that each dish was really different to the last one, and that it would be a little moment of sensory stimulation, of
Brilliant.
Enjoyment, and something she could relish every time she sat down to a meal, that it'd be something that would look good, taste good. And she also had some aversions to particular textures, so we tried to make sure that she wasn't presented with those, so that it was always a positive experience to eat.
I'm just thinking about this as a kind of almost a creative journey for yourself too. Did you have any background in health or nutrition or cooking or any of that stuff yourself?
Not so much in health and nutrition. I'd have had a running interest in science, and you know, I would have been the type of person who would have read The New Scientist every week and all of that.
Come on.
But I would have been looking for, or naturally looking for, a creative outlet. I'd always worked in creative businesses, in graphics or in animation and things in previous lives.
Yeah.
So cooking came naturally to me as another creative process.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I would always been more. I would have liked, when I was much younger, to think of myself as a budding artist, but really craft is...
Yeah.
Craft is what I gravitate towards, rather than I wouldn't call myself anything like an artist anymore.
Yeah, but it's funny. So I could feel the creativity in it, though. You know, it has that thing, you know.
Yes, yes.
So look, talk to me about the kind of core principles of the business then. You know, it obviously, you know, it really took off. It blew up, as they say. What are the core principles of Kayla's Kitchen?
Well, one of the founding, the founding approach to it is that if it's good for Kayla, it must be good for everybody else, and that's how everybody else comes to the food. But in terms of the food, it has to be every dish we make has to be good enough for Kayla, that what we put into the food, we would feed to Kayla.
She's like your super taster, is she?
She's our super taster, but she's the benchmark.
Very good.
Like, for instance, yesterday evening, I had a gentleman trying to give me a garlic and ginger paste for an Indian dish. I looked at the ingredients, and it had potassium bicarbonate and sodium phosphate, and you know, it had these strange things. And I just said to him, "Would you like a spoon of this stuff?" And he went, "No." I said, "Well, then that's not what we're going to use. We're going to make our garlic and ginger paste."
Very good.
And that's how we approach every single dish. Nothing comes out of a jar. We make all the constituents from scratch, and that's pretty much the guiding principle. We will not put something into a dish unless we put it directly into our mouths ourselves.
Wow, that's amazing.
And that's right down to the chili powder.
Oh, okay. Nice. Brilliant. Just give us an idea of the kind of meals that you're making and delivering.
Another guiding principle is that it's about variety. It's about good flavors, like good strong flavors. And to facilitate that, or in line with that, what I've done is included the best and most attractive of home cooking from around the world. So, you know, you can start from the basis of Irish traditional food. So we will have cottage pie and shepherd's pie. We have a fantastic beef stew, a lovely Guinness lamb stew. But then, you know, it goes further afield. So we've got the best of Thai dishes. We do all our Italian dishes from scratch, nothing out of a jar. We have some lovely Chinese style stuff, lots of Mediterranean from all around. We do Moroccan dishes from scratch.
Beautiful. Sounds fab.
We've a whole range of vegetarian. They happen to be vegetarian. We're not trying to force the whole vegetarian vegan thing.
Sure.
But it's there. We've lots and lots of lunch pots that are a whole meal in a pot with it could be a cannellini bean stew, or it could be a really mild Indian dal. Say we were cooking yesterday an Indian dal with red lentils, fresh butternut, and
Fab.
Fresh mango.
Yeah.
And then free-range Irish chicken. And there again is another one of our guiding principles. What we can get local, we'll buy local. So all of our meat is local, religiously. It's just we will only buy Irish beef, lamb, free-range pork, free-range chicken. And we get our fish from our neighbour. We've got Doyle Seafood right next to us.
Oh, close by. Well, that's fantastic.
I walked 20 yards this morning and got a whole pile of fresh sole.
Wow. Gosh.
And 20 yards back to the kitchen to start preparing.
Straight into it. And I know that you are kind of a delivery business as such. Have you been able to continue doing that during the lockdown?
Oh, absolutely. The Gardaí have been very... very, how would you say, accommodating. They wave them through every time.
Yeah.
We're an essential service.
Yeah.
So there was no question that we'd stop. And all credit to the crew. I've got two or three guys who work various part-time shifts, and there wasn't a question of any of the guys stopping. It was just, what hours? Do you want us for extra hours? We're up for it. So, yeah, we were all hands to the wheel.
And it's nationwide delivery still, yeah?
Nationwide, yeah.
Great.
If anybody's got an Irish address, we can get food to them.
That's brilliant. Before we give them the details on where to get you and where to find you, how is Kayla these days? How is she functioning and getting on with life and all the rest?
Well, she's generally in very good form. There's a kind of a roadmap for Rett syndrome, and you can do very little about the general kind of pattern of how things develop. They have different stages. They plateau. So Kayla's in a kind of a plateau phase where there isn't too much deterioration of skills. She's I would say gradually losing her ability to walk.
Wow.
But it doesn't seem to be affecting her mood so much, because we're slowly but surely improving her learning curriculum.
Okay.
So it, one of the things we have found all along is that the key to Kayla's mental well-being and spirit and morale is to make sure that she's continuously challenged intellectually. Now, she has very clear learning difficulties. She can't speak, she can't use her hands, so sign language is out of the question. But we have managed to provide her with an eye gaze device.
Oh, wow.
So that she can voice words from a screen using her eye gaze.
Amazing.
So she uses that primarily as a learning tool. So we tend to talk to her and improvise our communications at home quite a bit. But at school, her eye gaze device is her mode of expression.
Absolutely essential,
and
I'd imagine.
We've
yeah.
worked very closely with her teachers all along to continuously keep them challenging her with new topics. So Kayla will be just as happy to watch, say, a science, like a cosmology documentary on TV, as watching a kids' program.
Yeah, wow.
And, you know, maths is the thing that really brings a grin to her face. So, you know, she can multiply 2 3-digit numbers and that kind of thing,
wow.
which, you know,
brilliant.
Nobody really thought she was capable of doing until we said, you know,
look
watch this.
See. Yeah.
And she loves exhibiting her abilities like that.
Yeah, that's so. In some ways, the technology kind of almost opens her up a little bit to you know.
It did. I mean, we first got an eye gaze device for her when she was about 3.5 or 4 years old, and she was clearly, by looking at the difference it made, you could see clearly that in hindsight she had been utterly depressed.
Yeah.
Until she got the eye gaze device, and then she just brightened up as a kid.
Wow.
And ever since then, you know, her default look on her face is a big grin, big mischievous grin.
Brilliant. That is a beautiful story. Listen, Emmett, I want to give you an opportunity just to tell us where to find you. Kayla's Kitchen is the website the best option?
The website is where we're at, but anybody who feels that the internet is not for them, they can call us, or they can, you know, if you can get our number on the website, and we're happy to send out printed menus to anybody who would prefer to place an order over the phone if they don't feel comfortable working the internet. But on our site, it's like a big supermarket, food from all around the world, all from Japan back to Ireland. Lovely food there on the website.
And that's kayla'skitchen.ie.
That's it.
Emmett Harton, founder of Kayla's Kitchen, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's been a pleasure. God bless you.
Likewise. Thanks. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.